Chief Secretary.
Steve Stolfi, Core Search, Walters Kluwer, IPC member.
Natalie Dreyfus, trademark attorney in Paris, IPC member.
Oops. Pressed the wrong button.
Phil Morano, Katten-Muchin Rosenman, IPC member.
Alex Deacon, Motion Picture Association of America, IPC member.
Hector Manoff from Vitaly Manoff Feluchen, Argentina.
Jonathan Zook from the Association for Competitive Technology.
Heather Forrest from Australian Catholic University, IPC member.
Ikochi Lazarus from Nigeria, I'm also a member.
Ellen Shankman from Israel, IPC member.
John McElwain with Nelson Mullins, IPC member.
Mark Trachtenberg with Winston & Strawn, IPC member.
Michael Adams, Mayor Brown, IPC Treasurer-elect.
Jonathan Cohen, trademark lawyer, IPC member.
Nick Wood, cum laude, representing Marks, IPC member.
Luca Barbera, trademark attorney at Studio Barbera, IPC member.
Thanks. Pat Rainford, Federation of Intellectual Property Attorneys, IPC member and representing IPC in the Universal Council.
Brian Winterfeld, Katten-Muchin Rosenman, counselor as well to the GNSO.
Could you introduce yourself?
Simon Brian from IP Twins, Paris.
Sylvain Hirsch, IP Twins, membership application pending for the IPC.
Luc Chevalier, IP3, Paris.
Martin Küchenthal, Lemart GmbH, Germany.
Peter Dernbach, Winkler Partners from Taiwan, and IPC member.
Christine Dorain, National Arbitration Forum, not a member.
Griffin Barnett, Silverberg, Goldman, and Bykoff, Washington, D.C., IPC member.
Deborah Hughes, Katten-Muchin, IPC member.
Estanislao Mesadri from Mesadri Huarco, Argentina.
Analia Aspis, lawyer and researcher, University of Buenos Aires, Argentina. Fernando Barrueco from Brazil, president of Foundation Emirovsky.
Mark Lasik, Checkmark Network, awaiting membership status.
Olatunji Afolabi, National Information Technology Development Agency, Nigeria.
Nicolas Seger, Vitaly Manoff y Feluchen, Argentina.
Mauro Tabarovsky, Vitaly Manoff y Feluchen, Argentina.
Laura Plavnik, Ferreres Esteleche Busé, Argentina.
Marco Raffini, Guccio Gucci, Italia.
Andrew Barrett and Circa, not a member.
Don Finucane, Core Search, Walters Kluwer.
Patricia Rodriguez, Coca-Cola, Argentina.
Jose Viceto, Izquierdo Viceto, Argentina.
Elena Real, dot London.
Dave Jacquet, Microsoft, IPC member.
Amy Nolan, Granger, not a member.
Alfredo Morelli from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Argentina.
Linda Walter, Lakeshore Entertainment.
Fabricio Vieira, Time Warner.
Leon Sanchez, Individual Member, IPC.
Elizabeth Lay, Senior Counsel, ICANN.
Jean-François Poussard, Keep Alert, France.
Stéphanie Acroix, Keep Alert, France, non-IPC.
Andrew Marshall, ZA Central Registry.
John Dwyer, QVC, IPC member.
Janice Lang, ICANN staff.
Richard Graham, Richemont.
Hubert Welleman, .nl.
Maarten Simon, also .nl.
Sanna Salman from .fi. I'm a lawyer. I do dispute resolution in Finland.
Keith Barrett, Fish and Richardson, Washington, D.C.
Amy Bibbins, Bloomberg BNA Press.
Do we miss anybody?
Well, as Christina indicated, this is Steve Metallitz. Oh, by the way, do we have anybody on the phone that we need to introduce?
No.
It's open. It's open. Okay, thank you. This is Steve Metallitz for the transcript. We're starting off with a brief presentation from Save and Jarong, who are here to tell us about the engagement strategy for the Asia-Pacific region. One might ask why that's the focus here in Buenos Aires, and the reason is that there's a new ICANN program called CROP, Community Regional Outreach Participation Program, I think is the acronym, I may be wrong. In any case, it's to help the constituencies, our constituency, do outreach and get more people involved, particularly from the regions of the world where we don't have a lot of participation. It's great to see so many people here from Latin America, but for the predominant levels of participation are in the United States, actually in North America and in Europe. So we want to reach out to other regions. And with the Singapore meeting coming up next, because of the planning and approval process, we need to get started now or very soon to figure out how we're going to make use of this support and help bring some more people, get some more intellectual property people involved in the Asia-Pacific region. So we had put out on the list a request for volunteers to participate in helping us take advantage of this. I know a couple of those people are here, Peter and Ellen, and there's others that weren't able to be here. So we'll be doing, over the next month or two, we'll be trying to figure out how best to make use of this program, but the key is to integrate it with the ICANN outreach strategy, so that's why we have invited Save and Jarong to be here, and let me just turn the floor over to them for whatever remarks they would like to make, and then we'll have an opportunity for questions.
Thanks very much, Steve. Thanks for the introduction. My name is Jarong from, again, I'm the head of strategy for the Asia-Pacific based in Singapore. And what we have been doing is we just started, actually, the new office in Singapore covering Asia-Pacific since 1st August. So we're a relatively new outfit. We started with 2 staff. Now we have 5 staff. And we're really looking at thinking about how to engage the community in Asia-Pacific. Some of them are our long-time constituencies, or rather the word communities. And some of them, we have engaged them very strongly previously, but after some time, the engagement has dwindled a little bit. So what we have been doing the past 3 months is really going back to talk to these stakeholders and asking them actually what are their needs. So we're really in this listening mode right now. Some of the key findings of what we have gathered so far in the past 3 months, we're still working on an engagement strategy for Asia-Pacific. Save will talk a little bit more about Australia, New Zealand, and the Pacific Islands. But for Asia-Pacific as a whole, some common themes came up, and we are looking at these common themes and how we can work out comprehensive programs, or rather programs where we can engage our stakeholders better. Not only in terms of the traditional ones, most of our traditional constituencies are the technical community, but we want to reach out to other stakeholders that are considered non-traditional, like business, and even governments in Asia are not that well engaged, as well as groupings like non-government organizations. So the themes coming back again, some key themes. The first one is awareness. So not that many people know about ICANN within the region, especially Asia. And the second one is capacity building. So within Asia, the technical expertise and knowledge is really diverse because of the diverse region. Some countries are more developed. Some are really not that well developed. So there is a huge gap in this, and we need to help to build the capacity. Third one is language localization. ICANN's materials that we have, while we work very hard to have them translated in the 6 UN official languages, but not that many of these languages are spoken in Asia. The fourth is getting more Asia voices, especially involved in ICANN meetings as well as the internet governance sphere. Asians tend not to speak up a lot at international meetings, mostly not because we don't have an idea in our heads, but based on our cultures, we tend not to speak up as strongly as our European and American counterparts. So within the region, when you're more comfortable with each other, people actually do speak up. So the idea is, how can we profile these voices within the international ICANN meetings? And the fifth is stakeholder participation. So how do we increase to get more stakeholders to participate at various events, at various regional meetings, and come together to build a community? So these are the 5 themes, and we're very happy that we can share these key themes together with the IPC here. I know you guys want to reach out to Asia Pacific. We are in the listening mode, and based on these themes, if there are some themes that you feel that you have a common interest in, we can come up with ideas and to see how we can work together on these. Thank you.
Okay, Save for the transcript. One thing that we've been working with in terms of for the Australia, New Zealand and the Pacific Islands, when we come to this meeting, it's mainly the Oceania region. The Oceania is quite represented in terms of we have the Australian community that are, some of them are in councillors' position in the CCNSO, some are in the on the board of ICANN, and others that are actively involved in the working groups. But what the component that has been missing is some of the Pacific Islands. But you know, when we do introduce some of the Pacific Island community members to ICANN, they have taken on the role to actively engage. So that's a good sign, but I think we still need a lot more. So the good thing when we're talking here today about the CROP initiative on how we can reach out, what we have decided in the Oceania working group is that we need to form this working group that can actively engage with ICANN. So to date, what I can say is that. For the Pacific and Oceania region, we have a working group that has been formed. Tomorrow we will be having another meeting here. So far we've only had one meeting since the Durban meeting when we were formed. But we will be looking to engage widely with the communities. And I'm glad that this is, even for me, I've been in ICANN for a number of years. It's the first time I'm coming to this IPC meeting. And I understand that there will be a lot of your constituencies out there in the whole Asia Pacific that we could reach out with your help. So definitely, I think going forward, because we do not have a documented strategy as yet, we will, look to you for advice on who your members are in the regions, how we can reach them, or even if you have identified some of the events that you think you could go to, just informally, you could just send us email, because at the end of the day, I think under the program, it's the regional vice presidents that's going to work with you in terms of identifying which areas you can cover, if we cannot. So I think we are open to working closely with you. And I think I'll leave it at that and see if we have questions.
Thank you very much, Jarong and Save. Can we just open the floor to questions or comments? Absolutely. Ellen, and anybody else want to be in a queue? Go ahead, Ellen.
Thank you, and I find actually your cultural observation of the difficulty in participating based not just on language, but on cues to be fascinating. And I look forward to learning that. Could you please explain a little bit more what your target is by increased capacity? Capacity for what?
So there are, even in terms of, for example, coming to ICANN meetings, there are various groups of stakeholders that are not willing, or rather feel that inertia to participate at ICANN meetings because they do not really understand a lot of the issues. So one of the ways to bridge this gap is that we can come up with some suggestions that the community actually suggested, is that we can have briefing sessions for our Asia Pacific stakeholders for them to understand more about some updates. For example, they can't They can't come to the Buenos Aires meetings, but we can have updates for them within the region so that they can understand what are some of the issues that are being discussed. And when we have a meeting in Singapore in March next year, they can be up to date, and during that time, they can participate in the sessions better. So this is one example.
Can I just add that for capacity building in the Pacific Islands, it's mainly has been focused on other governments' understanding about the ICANN multi-stakeholder approach. Also, one of the things that's very highlighted from the region is more on the technical capacity. Like we have CCTLDs in the region that that require you know, best practices, how they can deploy DNSSEC and IPv6, and we partner with other organizations out there like the APNIC and NSRC and ICANN and ISOC, and we help out in terms of providing capacity building.
Peter?
Peter Dornbach. I just wanted a point of clarification. It sounds like there's a separate Oceania or Pacific Island working group. Are there also working groups for other areas within the region, or is that something that's being coordinated? How is that being coordinated? And if there are any other meetings that will be held while we're all here on site, could you let us know the time so that people who might be available and interested could participate?
Okay, thanks for the question. This is Save. On Sunday, we had a presentation to the whole Asia-Pacific group, and then Quack, who is the regional vice president for Asia, he you know, you heard from Jia Rong how they were collecting ideas from within the different meetings that they've had. There is an option for them to form a working group if the Asian community thinks that they should have a working group. When you look at the other regions of ICANN that have set up their strategy plans, they had formed the working groups for their own regions. So it's open, but I don't think that the community has come back and in deciding on whether they want to form a working group. But for the Oceania region, which will be a subset of the whole Asia Pacific, we've decided that we wanted to have a working group. So we've got community members from the CC, from government, from the academics, and the rest of the other groups that are engaged.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come and meet with us about this. I guess the question I have is really more informational. For those in the room, IPC members and not alike, where is the best place for them to go to find out kind of what working groups there are, who the contact person is, what the events are? Is there a centralized place on the ICANN site for that?
Yes, we have this GSC community wiki that we are promoting. And in that wiki, we will have all the working group members, the work that's going on in the working group. And even it's open to the community to, if you have a wiki account, you can input comments to that, and we are very open to that.
Okay.
We can help provide you the link.
Because I know that in the past, one of the obstacles folks have faced is that it you can't actually get access to the wiki unless you have a wiki account, but if you don't know that the wiki exists, you're not going to know to have an account. So I guess I was wondering, is there something on kind of the stakeholder engagement section of the ICANN site that folks could look at least get basic information to figure out, okay, this is the right place for me, I'll go sign up, et cetera?
Yep. On our GSE community wiki site, we will include information like just what I mentioned about the key themes that we found out, and you can paste comments. In fact, you don't need an account to comment. Yeah, so public members can actually go onto the site to view, and that would be a lot more helpful as compared to now I must sign up for an account, and what happens if my email doesn't work? So these issues, I think, are more or less resolved.
So just before we wrap up and thank our guests, as I said, we've tried to get a group of volunteers together to figure out how we can best make use of this opportunity. Focusing on Asia Pacific over the next few months, obviously, as time goes on, we'll be looking at other regions too. So if you are interested and you have contacts in the Asia Pacific region or are based there in particular, we would love to have you participate. So please just let me know, and we'll make sure to get you on that list. So with that, I'd like to unless there are any other questions. We can thank our guests. You're welcome to stay if you wish.
Our next agenda item is going to be a contractual compliance update from Maggie Sarab. Maggie, floor is yours.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Maggie Sarab from Contractual Compliance. Thank you for the opportunity to be here with you. It's a very short time with you, 20 minutes. And what I'm going to do is, if your time permits it, tomorrow, 8:30, please join us. We have what we call a high-interest session. It's on the schedule, and we will be providing and interacting with the community on compliance updates. With me in the audience today from the compliance team, I have Carlos Alvarez, I have Victor Oppenheimer, and Greg DiBiase.
First, we'd like to state that ICANN's bulk Who is an Accuracy complaint submission is now in production. This means that users can submit multiple Who is an Accuracy complaints in one single file upload. The system is based on a test pilot that we ran earlier this year in which that a user who agreed to the terms of use can submit up to 100 Who is an Accuracy complaints per week, with each complaint being treated individually per compliance's 1-2-3 process.
This is Carlos Alvarez, I'm senior manager with Maggie's team. A very brief update on 2013 RIA readiness. The essence of the message that we want to convey to your group is that compliance is doing every possible effort to be 100% ready on January 1st. We're creating 11 new complaint forms. We're updating 4 currently existing complaint forms. The team is being properly trained. Now, we are already addressing one of the provisions that's valid, effective upon execution of the 2013 RIA that's related to the who is format. Some registrars are not following the format that they should. We're addressing that via inquiries. That's basically the bottom of the essence that we wanted to convey to you. The new RIA, of course, gives us more teeth. It makes our work easier, provides us more strength, and provides more clarity. So our work is going to be easier with an increased volume, perhaps, but it's going to be more effective, that's for sure. That's basically the brief message that we wanted to convey to you with regards to this. Thank you.
Hi, this is Victor Oppenheimer. The takeaway from this slide is that as far as compliance's efforts, new ETLD efforts, they've been concentrating on the right half of the slide. If you look at the shape label transition to delegation, since Durban, our efforts have been in performing compliance checks to potential applicants wanting to sign registry agreements, and then building the complaint forms and the educational material, which we call Learn More and FAQs, for the various complaints that we anticipate we would be monitoring based on the life cycle of the birth of a TLD, the sunrise, claim services, once general registration is in place, dispute resolution procedures, what we call legacy complaints, meaning provisions from previous registry agreements that are in the base agreement for this round of TLDs, and other complaints that are really unique to the registry agreement, new GTLD agreements. And Just quickly, one back, Maggie. There's a link on the previous slide that you can, I encourage you to go and check our website.
I know we are zooming through the slides because we want to give you the opportunity for a Q&A. What you just heard is some of the, you know, there's a lot happening in the ICANN world these days. We continue to improve on compliance activities. We are preparing the compliance team to be able to receive and manage and enforce not only the 2013 RAA, but also the new registry agreement. In addition to that, we also launched and now are in the middle of year two audit program. This slide provides you a summary of the countries from where specific registrars were selected. It gives you a count by country. It is a random selection. What I want to highlight is under the registrars, the total selected registrars this year are 317, but you will notice that we have total year one rollovers. We have five registrars that we rolled in to year two audit for another audit. What that means is that in year one, those registrars were found that they're non-compliant in certain provisions, and they were collaborating, put forth a remediation plan, but the remediation plan required time. And by the time they executed on the remediation plan and provided all the information to ICANN, the audit program for year one had closed. So they were informed that they would be rolled back into year two. So they are now the lucky winners of another audit this year. From the registry side, as you know, it is not in their contractual obligation. So we still follow and we do receive collaboration. Some of the TLDs that are in the sample size have that obligation to be audited, but not all. Having said that, we have just closed what we call the RFI phase, which is the beginning, where we sent per contract the audit announcement to the team, to the contracted parties. We have used the compliance process to allow for collaboration. And now we've closed that phase, and we're moving into what we call the audit phase. The audit phase consists of reviewing all the documents that the audit program requests. And during the audit phase, we will continue the collaboration effort for compliance process with the contracted party. The annual audit program will be published for year two at the closure and sometime around end of April or June. Year two report already is published. So with that, I'd like to open the floor for questions. Christina, if you want to facilitate.
Sure, all right. Anyone like to be in the queue? Come on, Jonathan Zuck, don't disappoint me.
It probably wasn't worth the microphone. I think when we come to a new culture, we should embrace that culture entirely. And so any city in which you really don't eat dinner until 10, there shouldn't be any 8 a.m. meetings. I'm just saying, that should be a new rule. So, you know, at ICANN Geneva or something like that, you know, we can all be in bed by 8 p.m. And have 6 a.m. meetings. That'll be great. I think this half and half thing is not working for me. But so, Maggie, thanks again for your presentation, and I always enjoy them. And I know that I often give compliance a hard time, and it's really actually because it's where I see the most opportunity to have a more metric and measurement-based management than a lot of the other areas in ICANN. And I think that's really the issue. So, I mean, I think if anybody needed to look at the operation you've built compared to anything that's happened before, they could express nothing but glee, right? I mean, it's been a remarkable what you've accomplished in the time that you're here. The issue that you know I continue to press on from the standpoint of metrics is not just measuring them, but managing to them. And so I look forward to a time when you have a set of metrics that you're putting in front of us and saying, here's where we are now, and here's what I would like these numbers to look like a year from now. here's what we're doing to make that happen, and then a year from now saying, well, this we made it, this we didn't, and here's what we'll do differently in order to reach those goals. And that to me, that's the nirvana of sort of managing to the numbers that I'd really love to see over time is getting to this idea of managing to them, not just tracking them or following them, reporting on them, but to set objectives based on those numbers, because I think the organization as a whole suffers from a lack of definition when it comes to success. So we come in after the fact and try to find a way to make what happened appear successful, and that's not a healthy exercise for an organization that's grown as much as this has, as fast as it has, and the stakes that we have in the international arena. So I'm sorry to put all that on your shoulders, because it isn't really meant to be on your shoulders specifically. I actually just see the nature of your work is such that it's where the greatest opportunity to set the example for the organization as a whole exists.
So, first of all, thank you not only to Jonathan, but to everybody. We always welcome input. You're not giving me a hard time. We are here to provide that service. And if you don't tell us what your expectations are, we can never be able to meet those expectations. Now, there's one expectation, Jonathan, that I want to make clear. Tomorrow you will see how we are managing to the numbers. But please, I want to set the record clear, guys. To tell you how I'm going to be a year from now on some of the numbers, unless I'm missing something, and by all means, I'm willing to take your input if I'm missing something on this one. I don't know if we can predict complaints. So we're managing the numbers in certain aspects that I'll report on tomorrow, on turnaround times. We're measuring the numbers on closure rate. But I don't think we can manage the numbers. If anyone has a crystal ball in this room to tell me about the new G complaint volume, I would love it. Trying to predict resources, trying to predict tools, volumes. So all these things, you know, people say, you're not staffed enough. It's like, okay, what are we expecting, you know? So, and it depends which constituent group you talk to. It's doomsday on one end, it's confidence on the other. So tomorrow we'll present more. But what I want to mention to the team here, are you familiar on myican.org? We are, and there's a compliance tab that has a lot of information. To Jonathan's point, there's a lot of numbers. And we publish those without touching them. We internally take them and manage our operations. The reason this is up there because we get tapped by policy, by working groups, to help determine PDPs and get data. So this is there for you to use. So we will provide that. I can't help you with the 8:30 wake-up call thing. I'm sorry. Something I wanted and I neglected to share with the team in here is we do have a global presence now in Istanbul. If you're keeping up with our news or you look on our website, we have established an office in Istanbul. It's staffed with 3 people. We are in the process of almost finalizing on the Singapore candidate. With that, the compliance team now is will be 19, which is what we committed in our strategic plan for fiscal year 14. With that, we've completed the consolidation of our tools. We've completed all the FAQs. And I want to thank in this public Steve, because Steve Metalitz has reached out, like Jonathan too, in the past, and provided us input. So take a look at the website, at the FAQs provided, and let us know if there needs to be more clarity in that aspect.
I want to add something to what Maggie said, Jonathan. Since before the Beijing meeting, our team started doing analysis and metrics focused on specific regions. From that analysis, we conducted specific outreach activities targeted to specific registrars, first in Asia, then now in Latin America. The expectation internally to us was to have them fix the compliance issues that we had noted, like bulkly, in bulk with those registrars, and those issues were fixed. We had five or six registrars in Asia. They had quite a few issues, quite a few. And data retention, who is inaccuracy, target transfers issues, failing with their renewal obligations. Likewise here in Latin America, registration agreements, data retention, and everything's being fixed. And all that comes from the analysis of the metrics that that we have. And that's...
And just to clarify, I mean, I'm I'm worried about mention of a crystal ball, because I'm not saying anything about that or anything like it. I'm saying if you have an objective to publish it and manage to that objective, and I don't even think it's our position to be angry if you don't meet that objective. It just becomes a way to look at whether or not the things you did to try and meet the objective were in fact effective. And more often than not, what we hear is, well, we hired as many people as we said we would. Right? And that to me is not a metric. It's not an interesting number. Right? Of all the numbers you could be measuring, how many staff you have, it's not interesting. Things like the time to resolution or who is data accuracy, et cetera, those are interesting numbers. And they're hard. I'm not trying to say they aren't, but that's where we should be setting objectives and then plans to meet those objectives and then changing the plans if they don't work. That's all it's about. It's not about holding you accountable for the unknown. It's about just trying to set objectives and managing those objectives and changing the plan if they're not met. And that's not about a crystal ball.
Tomorrow, 8:30, Jonathan.
Yeah, I know.
All right, so I have in the queue Claudio, Steve Metallitz. I'm going to put myself in very briefly. Anyone else? I would ask all of us, myself included, to be quick. We have 5 minutes.
Sure. Claudio DeGangi. Maggie, my question was about the new GTLDs. The board accepted the GAC safeguard advice to basically go out and proactively sample the WHOIS data across registries and to identify inaccurate WHOIS. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the role that compliance is going to play in that, and will that also apply to the existing TLDs as well?
This is Victor Oppenheimer. Whatever is in the contractual obligation for registries, compliance will monitor. I know that's a general statement, but regardless of if it is a WHOIS, there is a specification already in place for publication data services, I believe, specification 5, I think. So we are, compliance will monitor that specification.
So Claudio, I understand the GAC approved that, but are you asking what is our role in what's gotten approved?
Yeah, I mean, the board accepted the GAC advice. I mean, the GAC advice was that the registries would do this, and then the board said, we're gonna take this, ICANN's going to perform this function in terms of going out and sampling data across the registries.
Right. So that's what we call monitoring in our space. That's why I gave you the look a little bit. So basically, when they are in production and effective and they sign the contract, as Victor is stating, there are two facets to compliance. There is what we call reactive work, which is based on complaints and identified issues, and there's the proactive space. I'll be honest with you, initially, proactively probably will take a little bit of, I can't commit to that, I'm just saying. It might be something we will explore once we strengthen and we tie. What we're focusing on now is outreach with the newly delegated TLDs. We just completed an intense session with several of them this morning where we explained the process, explained the expectations, the area of scope and how we will work with them and what's expected of them per process. So we're trying to kind of ramp up those efforts. But if and when that space becomes effective and we start doing our monitoring role, we will definitely, that will be one of the things we will monitor.
Thank you, Steve Metallis. My question actually was on the same point, and I think you raise a good, it's an interesting aspect of this, that because of the way the board responded to the GAC advice, this is not in the registry contract. It's the board said, well, you don't need to put that into the registry contract for the registries to do it because we're going to do it. In fact, what the board said was, we are doing it. We have the tool to do it. Well, today, several months later, we don't have the tool yet, but it's in process, as I understand it. And then the question is, how does that interface with compliance? So, for example, if the tool that ICANN is going to provide identifies apparently inaccurate WHOIS data at registry, at new GTLD of X, does that report get fed into your complaint process for false WHOIS data? Just how does it fit together?
Thank you, Steve. So yes, the effort, I know there is an effort in the registrar space similar to that led by a counterpart of mine at ICANN. And basically what happens is they will have the tool to sample and feed into compliance the the who is inaccuracy complaints. And then it will come through the process and we'll follow the compliance process, not only to ensure that it becomes accurate or that the registrar takes action about it, but also for reporting purposes. So yes, there will be a strong handshake from the entity who's responsible for that sampling to compliance to enforce it.
Thanks. I just wanted to let you and your entire team know that I don't get to say this very often, but I was very happy to see the breach notice that was sent to Dynamic Dolphin. And in particular, the section that I thought was really critical because it's an issue that those of us who do IP enforcement and combat online fraud and abuse run into all the time is the failure to enter into a registration agreement with the registered name holder. I note from the site that there has been a response that's under review. I'll certainly be keeping an eye on it. But I guess the question I have is this an area that you anticipate further focus on over the next year?
Yes.
Excellent. Great. All right. Well, I think that is it. I apologize that we had to shorten your time. We have a ridiculous agenda today. But again, thank you very much to you and your team for taking the time to come meet with us. This has been, and we very much appreciate all of our interaction and the cooperation between compliance and the IPC. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And please, thank you. Thank you. Please let us know. Continuous improvement. Don't complain, especially at 8 a.m. in the morning, right? That's the only thing I don't listen to in the morning. But give us feedback, productive feedback, like we've been hearing from you. And I thank you for that, because that's how we continue to improve when we come to this audience. Have a great rest of the week.
Thanks, Maggie. Karen, I believe you're up. So we've invited Karen Lentz to talk with us about RPMs, and I apologize to Karen in advance because I don't think we've been very specific about what it is exactly we want to know. So while she's getting set up, I guess, for those of you who had specifically requested this briefing, if you could just kind of raise your hands and, you know, identify the points in particular you'd like to know so Karen knows where to focus. Anyone? Okay, Mark?
Go ahead. Mark Trachtenberg. I am curious about finding out a little bit more about the allocation of the 100 domain names for founders programs and getting a little more detail on that. Some comments were made in the session the other day, and we could just get a little more information, especially on the parameters that will be considered when ICANN is reviewing these founders programs for approval.
Anyone else?
We did at the very last minute, and I again apologize, but we did send two topics that were circulated on the list to her. I do believe I forgot to copy you, Christina, so I apologize for that. But those topics did make it to where I think it was probably just a few hours ago, though, so I do apologize. But.
And I would just note, and those of you, I think some of you know this, but in response to the comment in the statement in the final RPM requirements that basically if the IPC and the GOTLDs were able to come to an agreement on a potential recommendation with regard to the kind of pre-sunrise allocation, the IPC has had a drafting team working on that. I did let Karen know that basically that we did have a drafting team. We were working on it. It seemed to be going well. Just as an update, we did have a kind of impromptu meeting yesterday with a group of representatives from the GOTLDs to let them know where we are, to get some input and guidance from them. I think that was a generally productive meeting. They have actually just come back with some of the information that we'd requested in terms of identifying kind of the categories of strings that they want to be able to convey to their corresponding governments, whether it's local, national, city, et cetera. So I anticipate that we're hopefully going to be in a position very, very soon to have something that's put out to approval for the entire IPC and then, you know, hopefully continue to advance the ball. So Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Christina, and thank you, everybody, for inviting me. I want to start out by saying that I know I only have 20 minutes, and there were a number of questions that came up in the rights protection session yesterday that we didn't get to. So I just want to offer from the staff side that we're certainly open to having follow-up discussions from this meeting if we don't cover everything here. So I was asked to talk to three topics, one being the name collision, alternate path delegation report with block names that was just put out and what the impact of that is on Sunrise, the framework for evaluating launch programs under the RPM requirements, and then sort of generally the RPM requirements. So on the name collision issue, what was published earlier this week was a set of blocked second level labels for each or almost all of the GTLD applications. The question that has arisen is because the plan says that those names must be blocked, what does that actually mean? You know, if they are blocked and then released at some point after the sunrise, does that mean they never had an opportunity to be part of a sunrise? So we're actually looking at that, how the term is blocked was intended. In terms of the other aspect of the name collision recommendations, there is a 120-day block, if you will, on activating any names. And so in that sense, it doesn't really impact the sunrise as names can be allocated, just not active in the DNS. So that's the approach that's been taken there. So we've actually gotten this question quite a bit this week, so we're planning to issue some clarification just on that point. Second question was on evaluating approved launch programs. And this is maybe getting a little ahead of the next topic, but under the RPM requirements are part of the registry agreement, and they specify the manner in which registries and registrars must offer the Sunrise and Claim services. And the final version that was posted did provide for a registry ability to request if they wanted to do some sort of program that would not otherwise be permitted under the RPM requirements. And it says, you know, that ICANN will, you know, review them, determine whether could contribute to consumer confusion, intellectual property infringement. It takes into account the amount of information that was available in the registry's application. The applications vary somewhat in terms of how much detail and what the plans were that they provided. But to the extent that there was a lot of detail provided and there was a period where that information was available for public review and comment, you know, what information was out there, what was the comment or reaction, was there concern expressed, that's taken into account. Also, whether a particular request has been approved in the past. So once you have a potentially a few that have gone through and been found to be okay, in the event that the registry was in a similar circumstance, there would sort of be a presumption of approval. But ICANN always has the right to review them individually in a case where it's determined that there's a unique or more complex issue raised by a proposal. We always have the opportunity to post it for public comment. So I understand from the registry community and from the community generally, there's interest in having a more detailed set of steps or factors that are taken into account in that analysis. So, you know, you can imagine looking at proposals that, you know, might be seen to be very low risk in terms of creating a risk of intellectual property infringement, some that might be, you know, very high, and then others where there's some doubt. But one of the factors that I think is built into the process is the scope or scale of what's being proposed. Is this sort of a limited case for, you know, X amount or this special thing, or is it this, you know, we want to do this for all of our names and all of these types of things. So anyway, I think it was Christina yesterday in the session that mentioned that having some of the analysis in what the decisions are would be helpful, which was well taken, and as well as being able to issue some guidance on the actual factors that fold into the process.
Mark Trachtenberg. What level of specificity are you going to require? Are you going to require them to actually present you with the proposed second levels that they would allocate? Or, I mean, how much information is going to be required? Because, you know, my concern is that these domains are not going to go through the sunrise period. And so that allows for, you know, all sorts of mischief. You know, for example, if a registry operator wants to, you know, sell a domain name to one brand owner when multiple people, you know, have registrations for that term, like, for example, Delta. If a registry operator wants to go to Delta Faucet and say, pay us $1 million, we'll give you delta.tld, then, you know, Delta Airlines and the 5 million other companies that have registrations for Delta don't have the opportunity to even access that second level domain. I mean, that's just one scenario, but I mean, there's, you know, plenty of others, and that's what concerns me.
Yep, thanks, Mark. So in terms of the level of detail that we ask for, I mean, we ask for them to give, you know, complete enough detail for us to review it. The ones I've seen, there have been a handful, are actually pretty detailed in terms of this is the exact policy that, you know, we want to use and apply, and this is what our users, customers would see. I think if it, you know, I can't say for sure, but I don't think any of them have actually gone down to the level of, you know, these specific names are the ones that issue their more categories or, you know, to qualify as this, it would need to meet all of these things. But certainly there's always the option to ask for more information if it's not clear what they're doing or if it does seem to be, I don't know, strange in terms of what it's doing with particular names or types of names. Examples of what would be, well, none of them have been approved yet. You know, so we're looking at them, but what we've seen has been kind of along the lines of what was proposed during the public comment period and the other stakeholder discussions. You know, they're looking at public institutions or things for their community or things of that nature. So the Founders Program is sort of undefined, but, you know, any request. Right. I mean, I think we would definitely err on the side of, you know, more opportunity for you know, public review on it.
Yeah. Claudia DeGanchi. Karen, can you talk a little bit more about the thought behind if the registration program was described in the application, why that would create a presumption of approval? Because was that, I guess in particular I'm thinking, was that part of the application scored or evaluated by the evaluators? And I'm just not, it's not clear to me why that would create a presumption of somebody, because at the time of the application there were no launch programs or anything like that. There was just a clearinghouse, and that was everyone's understanding at the time. So I'm just trying to connect the dots.
Yep, thanks, Claudio. So the reasoning behind it is that you know, this information has been available for a long time, and if in terms of where it is in the application and whether it was scored, that's kind of varies across applications. You know, there is question 18 on mission and purpose, which has a lot about, you know, your community and your goals overall, which a lot of people put their startup plans in there. There is a specific question on rights protection and how you're going to comply with the requirements, what extra things you might be able, you know, planning to do. So you can actually find it in different parts of the application. But, you know, to the extent that applications were available in you know, very clear detail, and there wasn't, you know, there was an opportunity if something did raise a concern or if something was, you know, seemed to be a serious issue, that probably would have been raised at the, at some point over the months that information was available. It's not a, you know, there's no automatic approval, but there's, you know, that's taken into account, the fact that the information has been out there.
All right, I see Mark. Anyone else want to be in the queue?
Just a kind of quick follow-up to Claudio's question. I mean, how could an application even get approved if it includes a founder's program that's not permitted under the rules? I mean, everyone had availability to the rules, and I don't know, you know, when you said that information was available, I don't know if you're suggesting that everyone else has a responsibility to review every application that was submitted to identify a problematic founder's program to object to. But, you know, that's, I don't think, reasonable. But, you know, I'm definitely more interested in the first question of how the application could get approved if it includes a founder's program, which is just not permitted under the rules.
So, in terms of the evaluation scoring, as I said, some of this was scattered throughout the application. When the rights protection question was evaluated specifically, it was on the criteria of, you know, have they shown they have the resources to, meet all that's required? Have they demonstrated that they know how to enter the four criteria? And so, some applicants' answers were along the lines of, we think we're going to do these and these and these things, but, you know, regardless, we're going to comply with the requirements, and if, you know, we can't do these things, we won't. So, you know, it kind of varies what the answer was and how it was found to be by the evaluators to pass. But, you know, in any case, the requirements now are the requirements, and they're part of the agreement, so they are binding on everybody unless they have a specific exception.
Anyone else want to be in the queue? I would just note personally that, and this is Christina Rosef, the transcript, I question the validity of the assumption that if there was something in a question 18 in terms of a founders program or a launch program on a question that wasn't scored with a, you know, what was it, a 90-day public comment period? I don't think it's a valid assumption to say that if somebody had a problem with it, they would have put in a public comment. I know, for example, that I read more applications than I care to think about. The only ones on which I put in public comments was where there was a provision in a scored answer that raised a concern, for example. So if it was just in the question 18, what's your registration policy, even if I thought it was the worst thing ever, it's not scored, it didn't, you know, there was no reason for people to think that that mattered. You know, I realize that the requirements are now final, but I would just note that, you know, kind of for future rounds, that if it is the case that ICANN will want comments on those types of programs, then it should make that very clear from the outset, and make also clear that the failure to comment would be kind of construed as a kind of sign of acceptance from the community.
Thanks, Christina. I understand your point. I wasn't thinking exclusively of formal comments in the public comment period. So there was a particular comment period for comments to be received to be taken into account by the evaluators, but the actual application comments have been open for months. Right, and it wasn't so much, you know, you needed to formally object as, you know, was there any sort of reaction by anybody expressing concern about something in the application? But I understand the point.
Does anyone have any other questions for Karen? All right, excellent. Thank you very, very much. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, super. All right, next, the folks from TMCH have been so kind as to join us. We, unfortunately, as I think I've said a couple times, we have a really, really tight agenda. So we've unfortunately only been able to allocate 10 minutes, and I apologize for that. but I know that this is definitely a group that will have plenty of, questions. So I think what we'll do here is just start off. I'll start off by taking a cue for any questions that folks have. And I know that there were some that were circulated on the list, but I don't seem I can't seem to pull them up at the moment. All right, I know that there were folks that specifically asked for a briefing from the TMCH. So you need to indicate what it is you wanted to know. Yeah. Is there any information that I have a couple questions, but is there anything that you okay, Claudio, go ahead.
Yeah, my question had to do with the declaration that the trademark holder signs or their agent about if the mark is subsequently canceled or opposed. Is that something that the clearinghouse is going to check against, or is that something that that ICANN should be checking against in the Sunrise dispute resolution policy that they're creating? It's just not clear to me how that element's going to work. So if somebody, you know, has a trademark, it's recorded in the clearinghouse, and then it's later opposed or canceled, and it's no longer active. Is that something we need to have ensure that's in the Sunrise dispute resolution dispute policy that the registries have, or what are your thoughts on that?
So this is Vicky Follins from Deloitte. To be honest, I haven't been following quite as much as I would want to in the Sunrise dispute resolution process. The one thing I can do say is, so trademarks are indeed verified every year. So if they get caught there on the cancellation proceeding, they're not going to get the SMD files. The trademark holder or trademark agent does sign a declaration or in terms and agreement. Sorry. The agent or holder does sign the terms and conditions of the clearinghouse saying that if something is changed on the trademark record, they will notify the clearinghouse. So in principle, they have the obligation to notify us. We do an annual check. And it's also possible that a third party, for example, if somebody would indeed in the Sunrise dispute resolution provide something to the registry that is canceled, they could file a dispute or provide that information to us so that we are aware, so that we can take a look as well. And if it's indeed canceled, we're automatically revoking it unless there's new information that is provided, if that is something that can help.
All right, thanks. I know I saw Brian. I see Hector. I'm going to put myself in the queue. Anyone else? Brian, go ahead.
Brian Winterfeld. Just a quick question. I know that we asked this on your last webinar, but I was just wondering if there was any update regarding the issue where currently there's a prohibition about including trademark registrations that have dots included in the mark, just to see where we're at with that, or if there's a time frame we can give, just because we have a few clients that are having some concerns about that.
So a new rule or an update on the rule has been designed on that, and we're about to publish it. Don't think it's going to be this week, probably next week. What it says is the following, and I can't give you all the details, but in principle it comes down to that trademarks with a dot can be accepted, except for when they would end with an existing extension or an extension under review.
Great, thank you so much. That's a fantastic update. We really appreciate it.
Hector?
Yes, I want to know if you can give us some numbers about the registration of a trademark until now.
Sure. So we currently have almost 17,000 trademark records into the clearinghouse. Whereas the 17,000, 25% of them are coming from trademark holders directly, which is about 1,100 trademark holders that we have currently at the clearinghouse. For agents, we have about 165 agents, so registrars or law firms that are acting on behalf of the trademark holders. Out of those 17,000 records, we have about 28,000 labels that could actually participate in a Sunrise because of the identical matches. So if a trademark has a space in it, for example, they would have the generation of a label with the space and without the space, and with a hyphen. So a lot of trademarks have a space in it, so they most will have then two labels. So that's why we have a bigger number of actual labels that could qualify for a Sunrise registration. And for UDRP, so as you know, 3 weeks ago we launched the ability to add abused labels based on UDRP cases or court cases. For UDRP cases, it is an ICANN accredited UDRP service provider that needs to have the case. And we're at this moment at 75 cases. The labels as such, I don't have the numbers. I'm hoping to have them tomorrow. But there have been already 75 cases submitted to the clearinghouse to use these services.
You mean URS cases?
UDRP cases.
Ah, UDRP.
Yeah.
All right. I'm next in the queue. Does anyone else want to be in the queue? No? All right. It's been my experience in reaching out to local council in two or three Asian countries in particular to get, obviously, you know, where the registration certificate is in Japanese, the information needs to be entered in Japanese, and I neither read nor write Japanese. So, for example, in reaching out to Japanese counsel to get the information in the format that I need, and I'm explaining what it is that I need and why I need it, it has been kind of surprising and somewhat disturbing to me that there seems to still be a pretty significant lack of awareness in some of these countries about not only new GTLDs, but the Trademark Clearinghouse in particular. I know that you all have done a lot in terms of that. We are the IPC. What is it, if anything, that we can do to help you get that awareness out? Obviously, the firms that I'm contacting now, they know. But, you know, that's not all of them by any stretch. So is there anything in particular that would be helpful for us to be able to do? Is there something that we can be doing to try and reach out to either our organization, member organizations that are in Asia, our members that have members in Asia, or, you know, frankly, anything? I think we're pretty open to considering anything that might be of assistance.
To be honest, I mean, any help that we can get, we've done a lot of outreach this year throughout different countries. We've been in Beijing, Taiwan, Hong Kong. We did a whole roadshow there with clients. I'm actually leaving to Japan on Sunday again to reach out there. It is correct at this moment that we are trying to do a bigger outreach in the countries where there are IDNs because this is new. It's a new something that is there. People are not aware because we see a lot of questions about also the fact that if they have a trademark with an accent, for example, that they now have to register that IDN, which in the past this was not the case. So we're trying to get the awareness there. But yes, I mean, if you can reach out to the different companies, if we can provide webinars, if we can, for example, we're closely working with INTA to get the webinars up so that we can get that outreach as well. And where we provide marketing material, we have translated our website, at least the services and all that, in 9 different languages already so that people in different languages can actually read what we're doing. We do plan to keep the real clearinghouse guidelines and all that in English to make sure that there's no interpretations on interpretation questions on that.
Claudio DeGangi, I had a question about the common errors. Are you still seeing a lot of mistakes with proof of use? Or is it getting better? Can you talk about that a little bit?
It's getting much better. The last time I think it was that we said 70%, we're now at 20% correct common errors. And the proof of use is indeed getting more and more clear. And a lot of people are taking the print screen of the website where their trademark is listed as a sample. So it's believe that that's the message is getting clearer and clearer.
Perhaps one more thing I'd like to share is the following. As you know, the Trademark Clearinghouse is offering claim services through the registrars and registries. It exists out of 2 components, the pre-registration notification and the post-registration notification. It's offered for 3 months. And there is an option for registries to extend that period. Currently, we don't see many response to that. But on the other hand, we hear from a lot of trademarks that they're actually a little bit regretting that it's only offered for 9 months and not longer. 9 months, what I'm saying, 90 days, 3 months, sorry. We have asked ICANN, and in our contract there is a possibility to offer ancillary services. We have asked ICANN whether on the front end, on our side, we can actually offer post-registration notification ongoing to the agents and trademark holders directly with the clearinghouse, so that the value that initially was anticipated to a certain extent would still be there. It's not the same clay services as are required currently through the RPM, because it has two components, but at the minimum we would be able to do the second component. And so our hope is that we would be allowed to do that, and we would appreciate obviously the support of the IPC in doing that.
Go ahead, Petter.
Sorry, just we had a webinar for INJ, and collected a number of questions afterwards from the audience, and most of them we could reply on, but there's still someone. Would it be possible for a non-exclusive licensee to obtain domain registration?
So, we, as the clearinghouse, we don't accept license agreements. Yeah. So we don't look at the license agreements as such, because we don't create a legal opinion. Yeah. We verify the information as provided. If you're a licensee and you're registered on the trademark record, in some cases that's the case, then of course, as a licensee, you can provide that information. If you sign a license declaration, as provided on the website, by the licensor and licensee, we don't make a categories in between non-exclusive or exclusive licensors. So in principle, yes, but the licensor is indeed at that moment providing the licensee on that licensee declaration. It's a template from the clearinghouse, the possibility to register the trademark record and to have this SMD file mention the licensee as licensee on the SMD file or in the SMD file.
Anyone else? Didn't see anybody? All right, I guess that's it. Thank you so much. We had thought that we might be having a very, very, very short briefing from Michelle Chaplow, who is participating in the meeting strategy working group on behalf of the CSG, but she has a conflicting meeting. So the next item on our agenda is the GNSO Council update, so we'll just go ahead and move that up. I'm hoping that Petter and Brian could just fill us in on the motions that are going to be voted on. If there's anything for which you need guidance that you haven't yet received it, I think now would be the time for us to get that sorted. So, Petter, Brian, floor is yours.
This is Brian Winterfeld. So we have two motions on the agenda for tomorrow. The first one is on the translation and transliteration of contact information. Previously, the council unanimously passed a motion initiating a PDP examining whether IDN registration data should be translated into a single language like English or transliterated into a single script like Latin characters. However, the draft charter for the working group was deferred and then withdrawn by the RYSG and RSG, who expressed concerns that the charter was too narrowly drawn and that the relationship of the working group to the ongoing work of the EWG on GTLD directory services was not clearly delineated. A revised charter is poised for approval by the council following clarifying amendments from the RYSG on how various registration data efforts by the GNSO, EWG, and Security and Stability Advisory Committee, or ESSAC, will coordinate to complement rather than compete with one another. Also, amendments more specifically flesh out the goal to weigh the benefits to translation or transliteration against any calculable monetary costs in making the changes. We have sent this out to the list. It has not changed since then. I believe we are voting yes on this. Does anyone have any questions or feedback to the contrary? Great. One motion down, one to go. The next motion that we have on the table is for the protection of intergovernmental and international governmental organization identifiers in all new GTLDs. The council is poised to vote on this controversial motion endorsing the IGO-INGO working group recommendations. I definitely defer to any working group members who are here presently. I know that we've actually had some discussion on the list that Christina helped facilitate from the working group. The vast majority of the feedback that we received is that we should support the motion and vote yes. There are some portions of the motions that, or there's some discussion about potentially breaking the motion out. It's very complex and very long. There were also just recently some revisions made to it based on some questions and feedback that were brought up during our working sessions over the weekend. We, Petter has distributed the revised motion to the list. So for the folks who are, particularly for the folks who participated in the working group, but really for everybody, if you could take a look at that and see if that assuages any concerns. The only concerns that were raised, I believe, were by Greg Shatton about one portion of the motion, and I think that's where there were some changes that hopefully kind of address his concerns and will allow us to uniformly vote yes, regardless of whether or not the motion stays in its entirety or is broken out. I can go into more detail about the motion specifically, or I can just answer questions and see if anyone from the working group would like to talk about their support or lack of support for the motion.
Why don't we, if any of the members of the working group that are here on the phone want to give us any overview, it's my understanding that generally the recommendation is to support the motion. If not, then perhaps we could just go straight to questions.
Just add quickly that the way we're going to vote on it is to first vote on the proposed amendments, and if that vote fails, we will vote on the original unamended motion. So that's just.
Is it clear from the list, though, if is Jeff considering whether or not he considers it friendly? And if he considers it friendly, then we won't be voting. Are we waiting for Jeff's determination?
I haven't seen the 100% clear reply on that, but seems that it's not seeing it as a friendly amendment.
Okay. So just to be clear, there were some amendments proposed. It's unclear whether they're going to be considered friendly and therefore adopted as part of the motion, or whether they're going to have to separately vote on the amendments that are being proposed. And if that fails, then we would go to the original language.
I have a question. I don't know. Does anyone else want to get in the queue? Two questions. First, who has seconded the motion? And second, there was some fairly extensive discussion over the weekend about, you know, perhaps seeking input from the general counsel as to whether or not the levels of support for different parts of the motion did in fact differ, you know, perhaps reorganizing. What is the current status of that?
Excellent questions, Christina. I'm not sure I can answer them for you. I will check and see who seconded it and let you know. I don't know off the top of my head. I can't remember. I know that Jeff Newman proposed the motion originally. As far as seeking guidance and feedback from the general counsel's office, I don't know that we've seen a determination about that either. So that's something else we'll have to look. I haven't seen anything on the list. I mean, it seems like all of that discussion that we did have extensively over, and you had really good points over the weekends, frankly, seemed to me to be have kind of swept aside. Or I don't know if people feel like the amendments that were made address those issues, but I haven't seen any further discussion on the list about feedback from the general counsel's office or if it's still considered necessary.
Thank you.
Any other questions, or is there anyone from the working group here in the room or on the phone that could talk a little bit about the work that you've done and how you feel about the motion as it is proposed.
I guess it's a no. One thing, I'm just looking quickly to see if it's on the council, on the agenda, who seconded it.
Wolf Ulrich actually seconded the motion.
Okay, good. Okay, so it has a second then. Good. All right.
I think that there maybe was guidance received from ICANN Legal about the voting thresholds. I think that ICANN Legal said essentially that approval of a PDP motion requires an affirmative vote of a majority of each house, and further that one GNSO council member representative of at least three of the four stakeholder groups support the recommendation. A supermajority vote merely makes it more difficult for the board to determine that a policy is not in the best interest of an ICANN community. In addition, at least one IGO-INGO working group recommendation, recommendation four, seek to impact new GTLD registries who have already executed the registry agreement and therefore should pass by a supermajority in order to be more clearly constitute consensus policy amending the registry agreements. And if there's no supermajority, then alternative implementation mechanisms may need to be considered by ICANN.
Last question I have is, do we have any reason to think that the motion will fail? And if so, is it the view that perhaps we might want to do some outreach to the GAC, which I know feels really strongly about this particular motion, to let them know that if it fails, it's not because we didn't vote for it?
You know, honestly, I know that we had robust discussion during the working sessions, particularly around seeking that guidance and what the majority levels that were needed. I mean, honestly, it didn't seem like anybody was against the motion. I don't know if people are just holding their cards very close to vest, but typically the people who I think might oppose this motion were silent, and I know that there was active participation from across the different constituencies and stakeholder groups in the working group, and so the sense I get from the council discussions, and I defer to Petter if he agrees or if he sees things differently, is that there does seem to actually be consensus and support around this motion, so I'd be surprised if it does not pass, again, unless people are sort of holding things close to vest and not being honest at the council table, which is a possibility.
Thank you. So I think that covers anything else on council. I guess at the end of the meeting tomorrow, after the first half of the meeting, when do the elections happen? Does that happen in the council meeting?
I think we start the council meeting with the election. I think that's at the beginning.
Okay. All right. And I doubt that there's any confusion, but in case, just to avoid any, we obviously would like you both to vote in support of, you know, both Jonathan as chair and David Cake as vice chair from the, you know, from our house.
You didn't want to consider the alternate candidate for chair? I'm just kidding.
Please don't do this to me right now.
Yes, we understand that, and I guess we should open up if anyone has any discussion points about either of the votes for the chair or the vice chair, but like Christina said, our understanding is that we're going to support the candidates that are being put forward unless someone says otherwise. We'd like to discuss it.
Anyone? All right. Well, thank you both very much. This is the end of our... this is the end of the open portion of our IPC meeting, so we'll take a short break and then go into closed session. We unfortunately have to ask those of you who are not active IPC members in good standing to leave the room. I regret that, but there are some sensitive matters that we need to discuss. Thank you.
Mark's upset his application hasn't been acted on. He wants
Mark who?
Come check Mark.
Well, how does he know he hasn't? Have I been talking about it in our closed session?
Well, he's saying he submitted it 6 months ago.
I don't
think so.
I think because they flagged it as like, this is a service provider. I think it got flagged.
In fact, that's one of the things we're going to be talking about.
I thought we cleaned up the backlog.
He said
we
something.
We thought
right.
Let me see.
Should we let him stay or? Yeah, no, I'm pretty sure, because he said something to me in Durban about it, I think.
And, let me see. Yeah. In a minute, I will. I have something else I gotta check. Mm-hmm.
trouble. It seems. What? Hey, it's my new buddy.